Many who are in the world today have been compelled to accept what some may call the circumstantial evidence for existence of God. Even Darwin and Einstein accepted that the existence of a God is the most probable explanation for the order and design of the universe and of our own personalities. But there are still many who wonder if there is any hard, fast, touch and see or touch and feel evidence that we can put our hands on to show that there is a God indeed. And of course, we as a people here believe that if there is such a God, that he surely must have expressed himself directly in some way. Because if he's powerful enough to create the universe and the world as we know it and mankind and everything around us, then he certainly is capable of communicating. So we are going to talk this afternoon about the subject of whether the Bible is a book that is historically correct or is nothing in the world but myth. Because I believe this is germane to the subject that we're talking about right here. It's very important. We, of course, understand, and this is a fact of science, that in order for there to be a first cause, that is the original cause of everything as it is today, that whatever that cause is, it must have intelligence. It must have intelligence. And the reason we say that is that order, as we see it in the world around us and in the universe around us, is not the result from time and chance. We all understand that. It's a basic understanding, a basic fact. And we also understand that if there is a first cause, and indeed there must be, that this first cause must be as personal as ourselves. And of course, what we're saying here is an inanimate object cannot make an animate object. And we, of course, have information about the Creator that is not firsthand, because we weren't there, and in many cases not what they call empirical evidence, something you can touch, taste, feel, or whatever, but rather we have what some describe as circumstantial. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I'm talking about the same thing Paul talked about right over here in Romans 1. And most of you, I think, you're familiar with this passage of Scripture. Paul says, what may be known of God is manifest in the ones who don't give their allegiance to it. But God has shown it to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they were without excuse. Now that's circumstantial evidence. We see the circumstances, we see things around us, and from that we conclude that there is a God and that he is powerful and that he is the source of all things as we know them today. But we are made to wonder, of course, having seen all of these things and knowing how powerful God is, we're made to wonder somewhat about God's nature. What do we know about God's nature? Well, just as it's difficult for you to tell anything, or very little anyway, about the kind of man that a carpenter is on the basis of a table he made, let's say, so also you can tell little about the character of the Creator by merely studying his creation. But information about his nature is important to us, because obviously he's the one to whom we all owe our lives and the one we must know in order to understand the purpose of our lives. If indeed this first cause, as we call it here, is a cruel tyrant, then he will not be concerned if we live the same way. But if he's honest and thoughtful, then he may require that of us too. In other words, the existence of God can be an academic question for us, but it nonetheless is a relevant question if we want to live within the light of reality. And I think that's very important for us to keep in mind. But this causes one to wonder, and we introduced this briefly in the beginning of our lesson, has God ever spoken? Well, I don't think any of you here have heard him. Pretty sure. But that doesn't mean he's never spoken, does it? Doesn't mean he's never spoken. Well, I think that there's a basic principle here that we need to take into consideration, and that is, how can you tell what a person's really like unless you hear them speaking or see them acting? That's how we judge what a person's like, isn't it? We listen to them and we watch them. Well, this particular thing is true also of the first cause or supreme being who created the universe around us. Unless he chooses to express himself or reveal himself to us as human beings, there is no way in which us as lesser beings, and to say it the least, can come to really understand the character of such a great being as God. The central question then for those who want to know what God is like is, has he ever spoken? And we do have reliable records of what he said. We know he has spoken. Down through the centuries, many of our forefathers have professed to tell us the very words that our God has spoken to them and the very deeds that he's done. We don't have to have firsthand knowledge of it or firsthand experience. But some people say, well, now just a minute. You forgot something here. What about these Greek and Latin myths that are so prevalent? You know, you read, and most of you I know are reading the Old Testament right now. About this week, we're going to finish up the book of Genesis, start into Exodus. But, you know, you read some of these things and you think, that kind of sounds like mythology to me. And some people on that basis just dismiss it as being inaccurate or being nothing more than myth. But we find out as we look at some of these Greek and Latin myths that such people as Homer, for instance, whose works are still available, in fact, they're the earliest Greek writings that we have available to us, go back to about 900 BC. And in this, this is 900 BC now, he described the scene as a God spoke in heaven, and it goes like this. Zeus now addressed the immortals. What a lamentable thing it is that men should blame the gods and regard us as the source of their troubles when it is their own wickedness that brings them sufferings, worse than any which destiny allots them. From this incident, then, we can see that this supreme being, Zeus, was expressing resentment that us human beings blame them for our misfortunes. Oh, just a minute. Wait a minute. We can't take the words of Homer as an actual account of our Creator's words, because these are just the product of Homer's imagination. It is from the Odyssey, a novel about the imaginary wanderings of Odysseus on his way home from the sack of Troy. That's what it is, imagination. What we're dealing with in this, then, is myth. Imaginary stories built on a skeleton basis of what was real military history. So we read here the words that Homer made up in his imagination. Now, if we're getting anything about God at all, what we're getting here is Homer's subjective idea of what the Creator might say, but not even Homer claims to be giving us the actual words spoken by the Supreme Being behind the universe. Now, this is an important distinction that we need to make in our search for words and actions of our Creator. The difference between myth made up by man's imagination and the history of what actually happened in time and space. Because there's a vast difference, isn't there? One is historically correct, and the other is imagination. I don't know how many of you ever went to the library. I know today it's not necessary because you can get it online. But you know, when I went to the library, one of the first things they took us to was the stacks to show us these are fiction. Which means ain't real. It's fiction. And over here are your reference books. Things that are real and true. And we've got to make that distinction when it comes to myths and legends and things like this that we find in the world around us. So, many of those say, well, but you know, that's not all there is out there in the world, you know. There's more than that. Out in the world, what we have today is a great number of religions that are of great antiquity. One of them in particular has to do with the Buddhists. And the Buddhist scriptures, as they are called. Now, in our search for any verbal communication that a creator has made to mankind, we need to leave out these purely imaginative creations of the Greeks and the Latins and so forth, and maybe turn to some outstanding human beings, like, for instance, Buddha, who is regarded by millions as a great religious leader. Men who claim to be able to tell us something about the realities of the universe. Now, this man, Buddha, lived about 500 BC. And he is regarded as a trustworthy religious leader by millions in the world today. But as we study his works, you know what we find out? The basis of his authority is in the heart of his own personal experience. And it's described in some passages I have here from the Buddhist scriptures in this way. When the great seer had comprehended that where there is no ignorance whatever, there is also the karma formations are stopped. Then he had achieved a correct knowledge of all there is to be known, and he stood out in the world as a Buddha. Now, I want to emphasize, they claim there's been Buddhas back, and they claim these Buddhas lived as much as 2,000 years. I learned that just recently. For some reason, I never picked up on that one. I only went right straight to this character here. But he claims to be part of a long succession. And by the way, he didn't live to be 2,000 years old. That kind of changed, I guess. But anyway, he passed through the 8 stages of transic insight and quickly reached their highest point. From the summit of the world downwards, he could detect no self anywhere. Like the fire when the fuel is burned up, he became tranquil. He had reached perfection and thought to himself, this is the authentic way on which so many seers who also know all higher and all lower things have traveled on to ultimate and real truth, and I have obtained it. Now that's a direct quote I put up there for you. Direct quote. Now, this fella, known as Buddha here, failed to mention anything about a creator in this. Didn't you notice that? In fact, in looking into the works that I had available to look at, I found out that it's doubtful if he actually believed in a personal, objective creator at all. his writings seem to point to reincarnation of people who keep coming back and trying to get to a higher level. And where's the room for a God in there? There really isn't any. In fact, he doesn't deal in his work with first cause. Also, it's doubtful that he regarded God as being any more than a state to be achieved and experienced. Actually, he stressed a method of transcendental meditation, the purpose of which was to help people adjust psychologically and physically to an imperfect world. And this was his emphasis, rather than any claim to be able to tell us what the Creator was thinking. But there is even a greater problem with the Buddhist scriptures. Through them, Buddhists have developed a different attitude toward history than what we might call Westerners in their thinking. The result is they make no distinction between what was written in 500 BC by Buddha himself and what was written over the next 1500 years. Although Buddha wasn't there. So that now, today, even the original words of Buddha are very difficult to separate from the mixture of comment and myth that are in the Tiberian scriptures, which extend to, 325 volumes. 325 volumes. So in our search then for verbal communication from a creator, we have to lay aside the non-historical emphasis, which we find in the mixture of early and late commentary on the psychic life that characterizes collections such as the Buddhist scriptures, as they're called. We've heard a lot in the recent past about the Quran. And we need to look at some scriptures here that make a distinction between the original record and the latter commentaries that are attached to this, because not all of this was written down by their spiritual leader, Muhammad. Around 610 AD, a man named Muhammad was asleep or in a trance when he claims the angel Gabriel came to him and said, "Recite." He replied, "What shall I recite?" The order was repeated until the angel himself said, "Recite in the name of your Lord, the Creator, who created man from clots of blood. Recite, your Lord is the most bounteous one, who, by the pen, has taught mankind things that he didn't know." And he claims that when he awoke, these words seemed to be inscribed upon his heart. That sounds like Ellen G. White, doesn't it? Anyway, but according to Muslim tradition, this was the beginning of revelations that Muhammad continued to receive about God. They were remembered by other people, however, before being officially collected about the year 650 AD. And you see what I'm saying? It's hard to sift out what Muhammad actually said or wrote and what was written by people later, which was nothing more than what they observed or comments on what they observed. But in these things, Muhammad tells us that the Supreme Being is merciful and forgiving, stern in retribution and justice, and demands faith in his apostle, Muhammad. Now, if you are familiar at all with the writings of Joseph Smith, Jr., you have seen this same type of thing. If you want people to believe you're a prophet, then you tell them God has spoken, and you give them a good revelation that includes you in the plan. Who's going to question that? And he did the same thing here, same tactics here. But the question is, where does Muhammad get his information? Well, obviously, since he calls mankind back to the religion of Abraham, he was able to get a great deal of this original information whenever he read from the Old Testament. Now, I want you to remember now, this is not 650 BC we're talking about. This is 650 years after the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. You see, the Muslims are latecomers on the scene, really. They're latecomers. But you say, well, now, how could he have gotten this from the Old Testament? Well, history bears out that he was raised by his uncle. And his uncle was a trader. And his uncle took him on the trade routes as he was growing up, which exposed him to Judaism, to the doctrines of Jesus Christ, and to various idolatrous things as well, which I understand that his hometown of Mecca was pretty much caught up in idolatry, which thing he disdained, which I agree with him on that. There's no question about that. But there is no way that we can conclude that this man got this revelation anywhere than just by reading and coming up with whatever he happened to think in his mind. In fact, if you read the things he wrote, you can see that the rest of what he wrote, besides what he quoted from the Old Testament, was subjective mystical experiences or revelations, as he called them. That's what they were. Now, is there any way to confirm these actually came from the Creator? Is there any way to do that? You know, there's no way for us to get inside a man's mind and prove that the ideas that existed there were from an external source rather than from his own imagination. But in other words, Muhammad's ideas may exist simply in his own mind. But there is no way of corroborating it. We are at the mercy of subjective experiences. That's all that we have to prove. But you might say, well, now, weren't some men chosen by God for God to reveal things through them? Yes, they were. Absolutely. But the question would be in this, is this man unique and likely to have insights or the things that ordinary people do not possess? Is it possible? Is it possible? Well, you know, one thing I noticed about the people through whom God worked in the New Testament was they could confirm what they were saying came from God by performing miracles. But guess what? Muhammad disclaimed any power to perform miracles. He was smarter than Joseph Smith Jr. Joseph Smith Jr. claimed he could perform miracles, and when he was told to put up or shut up, he had to shut up. But you see, if you don't claim to perform miracles, you don't have to put out any miracles, right? Makes sense, doesn't it? But you see, if he doesn't have the power to do miracles, how do we know that it came from God? And then when we examine this man, we find him involved in vengeful and just plain sinful incidents in his life. And they are not few, they are many. Plus the fact that he died just like an ordinary man. He died like Buddha and he died like Homer. Just an ordinary man. So we can see that these so-called holy scriptures that so many people refer to, which are regarded by some as to be communication from God to man, are either the creation of a literary man's imagination or the non-biblical historical accumulations of psychic commentators or the historical accounts of a man having subjective visions in his head. but it seems very difficult to find historical accounts of actions and words that are corroborated by many sources over a long period of time coming from a supreme being. Is there, in fact, touch and see empirical evidence anywhere of this kind of communication by the Creator to His creatures? And the answer to this comes down to considering some important questions that we're going to do in just a minute. I hope I can get through this. The first one is, first question, is the New Testament history? Well, yes it is, actually. From 26 to 29 A.D., the New Testament tells us that a unique human being lived in Palestine. His life was observed and recorded by a group of men, excuse me, whose writings exist today in a collection known as the New Testament. Their record shows, I knew I shouldn't have been singing tonight. I just couldn't help myself. Brother Bob Bolton told me years ago, he said, you're going to find out when you preach for a while that your singing voice and your preaching voice are two different things. And there's going to be times when you can't sing and preach. You just can't get through it. Thank you, Mark. No, it was all the one I had up here. Appreciate it. Well, now I'm going to have to talk with a chaw in my cheek here. Thank you, darling. We have the emergency stash back there. And they're sugar-free, by the way. Just want you to know that. Not to fear. Okay. Let's talk about this then. We have people who wrote down things that they observed, things that they heard, and their collection shows that this man Jesus spoke and acted as you would think that the Son of the Creator of the world would. That's what they have recorded. And they record that he died, that he disappeared from the earth, he came back for more than a month to prove that he actually had been through death, been to his Father, and was indeed the supreme being alive in human form. That is Emmanuel, God with us. Now, you say, well, just a minute though. How does this vary between the myths? There it is right there. His life was recorded by eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses. All of these things were things that people observed. They saw these things. Not they heard it from a friend of a friend of a friend, but they actually saw it. Now, let's compare it to the Greek, Hindu myths or Buddhist and Islamic scriptures here. The New Testament is reliable history, not myth. It never claimed to be myth. And it wasn't myth. It was reliable historical accounts. And someone says, well, how do we know that it's reliable history? Well, that's an important question. To merely make that assertion is not enough, is it? But you go right back to what we just said a minute ago. We have eyewitness accounts. Eyewitness accounts. Peter and John saw Jesus actually heal lepers. They saw the nails driven into his hands. They put their fingers into the hole in his side when he arose from the grave. They didn't relate something that came from a friend of a friend. They talked about what they actually saw. In 2 Peter 1, 16 through 18, Peter says, "We did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For he received from God the Father honor and glory when such a voice came to him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.' And we heard this voice, which came from heaven when we were with him on the holy mountain." Now, how do you argue with that? Eyewitness testimony. Now, someone says, "Well, yeah, okay. But how do you know that's true? How do you know it's true? Do we just have their word on this, that they were there? Is that all we have?" And you know what the answer is? Not at all. Not at all. Hundreds of references and writings of those days confirm that Peter, John, Paul, and Luke, other writers of the New Testament books, were well-known figures of the time, that they actually were there. In his public defense before King Agrippa, Paul said in Acts 26:26, "For the king, before whom I also speak freely, knows these things. For I am convinced that none of these escapes his attention, since this thing was not done in a corner." What did he mean by that? Now I'm going to drown. I needed that. Anyway, everybody knew what was going on. It was no secret. It wasn't something happened in a dark area down by the railroad tracks when a bunch of guys were drinking booze. This was right out in the open. And that's what Paul appealed to here. But also, Paul said, in 5 Corinthians 15:6, that Jesus was seen by 500 at once when he was resurrected. 500! You know what that means? He says at this time, most of them are still alive when he wrote that. That means in 56 AD, most were still alive who saw the resurrected Savior. Think about that. Out of 500 people in 56 AD, most of them were still alive who had seen the resurrected Savior. So this wasn't something that was just dependent on the word of a couple of men or even 12 men. This was something that many could attest to, eyewitness testimonies. And all the thousands of references to Paul in the letters of those days confirm that both eyewitnesses and the things they wrote about were true. The writings of men like Clement of Alexandria, Barnabas, and Ignatius of the first century are filled with references to the written records of men like Paul and Peter and John who wrote about Jesus firsthand. Even the next generation after them recorded interviews with them. Did you know that? Papias, who lived in 60 AD, records what the old apostle John told him about the writing of the Gospels. Can you believe that? 60 AD. He says, Mark, having become Peter's interpreter, wrote accurately all that he remembered, though he did not record in order that which was done or said by Christ. Now remember, Luke wrote in what? In order. Mark wrote these things down, not necessarily in order. Then he said, subsequently, as I have said, he attached himself to Peter, who used to frame his teachings to meet the immediate wants of his hearers, and not as making a connective narrative of the Lord's discourses. So Mark committed no error as he wrote down some particulars just as they were recalled to mind, for he took heed to one thing, to omit none of the facts that he heard and state nothing falsely in his narrative of them. Now that is recorded in the works of Eusebius, Book 3. This is taken from an interview by Papias in 60 AD. Irenaeus, who died in 203 AD, tells in writing how Polycarp, who died as a martyr in 154 AD, would describe his intercourse with John and with the rest of those who had seen the Lord, and how he would relate their words and whatsoever things he had heard from them about the Lord and all his miracles and his teachings. Get that? Polycarp talked to eyewitnesses, people who had firsthand knowledge. And he says, To these things I used to listen diligently, even then by the mercy of God which was upon me, noting them down, not on papyrus, but in my heart. But guess what? Someone says, but guess what? These guys were fans of Jesus. They were fans of Jesus. Now, of course, they're going to write those things. Well, guess what? We've got hostile witnesses, too. We've got hostile witnesses. People who did not believe that Jesus was the Christ, but who were honest enough to record what they observed and what they heard. Now, if this thing was not done in the corner, historians are bound to pick up on it and make references to it. So we have non-biblical, non-Christian historians like, and I'm going to really mess this one up, Porphyry. I wanted to say Popery, but it's like Porphyry, who lived 235 to 305. Celsus, who I referred to in class this morning, 177 AD. Josephus was not a Christian, he was a Jew, 37 to 100. Pliny, I'm sorry, I get behind here, I get excited. Pliny the Younger, 61 to 112 AD. And listen to this. Pliny the Younger was raised by his uncle, Pliny the Elder. They were nephew and uncle. And Pliny the Elder died at the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD. Interesting little bit of information there. But all of them confirm the same thing. The New Testament writers wrote truthfully about the events that they observed personally in Palestine in the first century. We go on down, find a fellow named Tacitus. Tacitus was not a Christian. He was the leading historian of Imperial Rome. And he said, the author of that name Christian was Christ, who in the reign of Tiberius suffered punishment under his procurator Pontius Pilate. What? That's right. That's what he said. The Jewish historian Josephus writes, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day. Josephus wasn't a Christian, but he observed what he heard firsthand, or from people who saw it firsthand, because remember, he lived 37 to 100 AD. Interesting. Very, very interesting. The public nature of the record and objective, documentation of the facts recorded by Paul and Peter and the others is also evidenced in a very plain statement by Tertullian, who lived 160 to 225, who was the juris consult familiar with Roman archives. That was his title. And he says, I quote, Tiberius, accordingly, in those days, in whose days the Christian name made its entry into the world, having himself received intelligence from Palestine of events which had clearly shown the truth of Christ's divinity, brought the matter before the Senate with his own decision in favor of Christ. The Senate, because it had not given approval itself, rejected this proposal. Caesar held to this opinion, threatening death against all the accusers of the Christians. This is in Tertullian's Apology, chapter 5. No other history has been better corroborated by eyewitness records than what we read in the New Testament. No other history. And in addition, we have reliable manuscript evidence of these accounts. Now remember, myth is imaginary stories built on skeleton basis of real history. The kind of stories that spawned hundreds of years after Buddha and Socrates and all these other guys died. Now, how do we know we are reading in the New Testament what the eyewitnesses originally wrote? How do we know that they or their followers in any way didn't exaggerate or embellish them in some way? Well, that's a good question. But let's look at the manuscript evidence here. Myth is developed when eyewitnesses and their records die. Notice that. When the eyewitnesses and the records are dead, that is, they're not available, and people start exaggerating things, kind of like a fisherman, you know, that fish that started out this big, and give it a couple of years and it's this big, you know. Well, that's kind of the way this is. Simple occasions or events that happened suddenly take on all kinds of mystical things that make them exciting when the story's told. But that's what happens. Now, in the case of Caesar's History of the Gallic Wars, there is a considerable period of time that existed. In fact, about 900 years from the time he wrote it to the earliest manuscript. Now, the earliest manuscript is going to be the one that is most accurate and most likely to be closest to the original. Well, what has happened, though, in the time period in between, even though maybe some originals were not destroyed immediately, time takes toll on the originals, doesn't it? The originals deteriorate and become hard to read. And thus, whenever people copy them, they can very easily insert their own idea or their own thought and make it a little more exciting than what it was originally. But unfortunately, Caesar's Gallic War is dependent on only 10 manuscripts, and the earliest manuscript is dated 1,000 years after he wrote it. That's what's extant to us today. 1,000 years after he wrote it. So the late age of the manuscript leaves plenty of room for the development of a myth. And we're going to be talking about this chart as we go along here. I'll be popping it up. But notice Caesar, right, the Gallic Wars, 100 to 44 BC, earliest copy is 900 AD, the time span being approximately 1,000 years. And there's only 10 copies of it available in the world. 10 copies. But he's not the only one. Some of you have heard about Plato's Republic, haven't you? Plato, of course, had an idealistic idea of what things ought to be. But he wrote it in 400 BC. And guess what? There's only 700 manuscripts, and the oldest copy of it is 900 AD. That's what, 1,200 years from the autograph? That's something, isn't it? And look at this, only seven copies. Only seven copies are in existence today. The same kind of manuscript evidence, though, is accepted as proof positive that these copies we have of the classics are reliable productions of what the authors originally wrote. People will argue for that. But we accept the historicity of other things as well, such as Herodotus' history on the basis of eight manuscripts, of which the earliest manuscript is 875. 1,300 years span, and only eight copies available. There's also Aristotle's works, only five manuscripts, and the earliest manuscript is 1,100 AD that we have. Look at this. It was written back in 384 to 322 BC, 1,400 years, and there's only five copies available. That's it. Then, of course, this has got to be Lucretius. I'm going to say it is, okay? Lucretius works with two manuscripts, and look at this. He died in either 55 or 53 AD. Look, 1,100 years went by to the earliest manuscript available. 1,100. And guess what? There's only two. And they're not complete, by the way. They're not complete. You see how this stuff happens? Manuscript evidence, though, for the New Testament, we see that the oldest piece of manuscript which we have is not 1,400 years or 750 years from the autograph, but it is, in fact, only 35 years. And by the way, there's a picture part of it right there. That is the oldest manuscript that is in existence today of John's Gospel, penned 35 years after John first wrote it. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? But notice now, some of John's contemporaries would have still been around when this piece of paper was being passed around. Think about it. Think about it. People who lived with John and knew John handled that piece of parchment right there. They handled it. Wow. Just kind of boggles the mind just a little bit, does it not? But how many manuscripts from 125 and 1100 AD. How many are there? Now, this is what's really interesting. If we look, I forgot Suetonius over here. How did I forget him? I'm sorry. I got excited and forgot him. These are all the guys that, just a minute. I was going to mention them later. I just got behind myself. I'm sorry. I want you to look here at the New Testament, though, right here. We're going to come back to this. 48 to 100 AD is when the New Testament was penned, all right? The oldest one we have is 125 AD. Are you getting this? 125 AD. 25 years, approximately. And I think the estimate that was on the other thing I read said 35 as a possibility, but that would give allowance for it having been written within the last 10 years of John's life. But look at this right here. 4,000 plus. 4,000 plus. How could that be? How could that be? All of these other guys over here, look at this. There's 8. There's 9. There's 20. Wow. And there's 10 and 20 and 8, and but they don't compare. They don't compare. There is no book of antiquity that compares. Not a one. This papyrus fragment that we talked about here, which now is in the John Ryland's Library in Manchester, England. I'd love to visit that someday, actually, which we already looked at. That's history. That's not myth. That's not fantasy. That's history. Let me see if I can get out of this. I've got all kinds of moving things down here. There we go, right there. Now we're out of it. Now, if the New Testament is not reliable, and if the New Testament is not history that we can trust, then no ancient history can be trusted. Think about that. On the flimsy evidence of even as many as 20 manuscripts that are far past the autograph, how can we know that's right? How can we know it's accurate? We can't. But we've got over 4,000 Greek manuscripts. And by the way, there are 8,000 Latin manuscripts dated between 125 and 1100 AD. In all, by the way, of biblical manuscripts that are available for translation, there's over 20,000 now. That's Old and New Testament combined. Over 20,000. And some of those, by the way, include those that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were of great antiquity, by the way, and a real great source of information. If we say that the New Testament is myth, then basically history doesn't exist. That's what we're forced to conclude. But we obviously know that isn't true. The fact is that Caesar and Plato and Tacitus existed, and the record of every detail of Jesus' life in the New Testament is true. And we have to face the fact that there lived upon our earth around 2,000 years ago a man called Jesus, who was perfect in all his ways, who had power over sickness and nature, and who could not be killed, and who talked and lived like the Son of God he was. And it is on that basis that our faith rests. We can say with confidence, he lives. He lives. And he will come again to receive his own. There's no reason for us to have any doubts whatsoever about this. I hope this lesson has been beneficial to you. I know it went a little longer than what we're accustomed to. But keep in mind that I let you out right at 12 this morning, and maybe it'll help make you feel better. If not, I'm sorry. But I knew when I prepared this, it was going to take some time to get through it, but I wanted to share it with you in one lesson instead of trying to chop it up, because you lose some of the impetus or some of the thought in the process when you chop it up too much. I didn't want to do that. So I hope you appreciate that, and that this will be something that you'll find to be beneficial to you in your understanding of God and his precious word. And again, I apologize for my raspy voice and for my bulging cheek and whatever else I had to go through here this afternoon. And I appreciate your patience very much. We offer once again heaven's invitation to you. If you're not yet a child of God, we want to give you the opportunity to become one. And if you are a Christian who needs the prayers of your brethren, we offer that opportunity while we stand and while we sing. Won't you come?